The weather and climate often cause concern and curiosity. But understanding the facts behind the phenomena can be a challenge. We're here to help. From the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Illinois Public Media, welcome to Weather Realness, a weekly podcast about the skies above Illinois and the world.
I'm your host, Deanna Hintz, Associate Professor in the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign.
Super El Nino.
Super El Nino.
The Super El Nino.
Super El Nino.
A strengthening El Nino is likely to reshape the season.
El Nino is here, which means the eastern tropical Pacific Ocean is rapidly warming. And this can affect weather patterns worldwide from hurricanes, winter storms, drought, and rising temperatures. But some forecasters and media outlets have described this year's El Nino as a possible super El Nino. Joining us to discuss what this all means is Dr. Emily Becker, Research Associate Professor in the Rosenstiel School of Marine, Atmospheric, and Earth Science at the University of Miami. Emily, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for the opportunity, Deanna.
Well, before we dive into what a super El Nino is, can you explain a bit just what is your standard El Nino?
Yeah, sure. So El Nino is the first order of El Nino is warmer than average surface water in the tropical Pacific Ocean, specifically the central to eastern tropical Pacific Ocean. And even though that water is only a few degrees warmer than it usually is, that means that a lot more clouds and rainfall set up over the central and eastern Pacific than usual. And the entire global circulation, the entire global atmospheric circulation is driven by the tropics, because that's where the sun comes in and it's the strongest, and the atmosphere is constantly trying to move that heat from the equator towards the poles to try to even out these gradients that develop. So when you shift where you are seeing a lot of rising air and a lot of storms, then you shift the global patterns of where the storm tracks form and the jet stream and all those major features that determine where our rainfall and temperature patterns set up.
Well, yeah, well, you said a lot about why it's maybe important to pay attention to it, but how do scientists monitor this phenomenon?
You know, it's really interesting. For many, many years, we measured the surface of the tropical Pacific, just like I mentioned, in this region we call the Niño 3.4 region. It's a box in the eastern central Pacific, and we measured the sea surface temperature there. And for many, many years, that was enough. It gave us an accurate representation of the strength of El Niño and La Niña events. But just this year, in fact, we needed to make an adjustment, and now we compare that temperature to the entire tropical oceans. So we call this the relative Niño 3.4 index, and this is to account for the fact that the global oceans are warming rapidly.
Well, interesting. So that seems to be that, I mean, now there's this additional challenge maybe of both monitoring El Niño, but also its predictions. So why does El Niño, for one, like happen irregularly? It happens every about 2 to 7 years, but also what are some of the challenges in its prediction?
So El Niño is actually pretty incredible because we can see an El Niño event coming 6 months or a year, sometimes 2 years ahead of time. And if you think about, I mean, other than knowing that winter is going to follow summer, we don't really have much we can predict when it comes to the weather and climate on that kind of timescale. We are also quite good at predicting the overall warming trend that we're seeing. But when it comes to El Niño, essentially the tropical Pacific Ocean has a gradient itself is cooler in the east and warmer in the west. And that is because of the way the world rotates and the winds that blow across the tropical Pacific. So those trade winds that are constantly blowing from the east towards the west, sometimes they weaken. And when they weaken, they can allow that warm water in the west. It's a lot of W's. Warm water in the west to slide backwards towards the east and initiate an El Nino event. And it does recur on, just like you said, that 2 to 7 year time scale. And it's not terribly predictable in the sense that we know it's going to recur every 7 years, but we do have a good sense that we will see an El Nino event and a La Nina event repeating in the course of that 2 to 7 years.
Yeah, when I think about that, that sloshing of that, that warm pool, the Pacific warm pool, which is in the Western Pacific, back across the ocean, which touches a subject that has been very near and dear to my heart in terms of research, which is tropical cyclones. And so, that activity of where it's going to be and where it's going to focus in the basin has a lot of impacts on, the people who live in the Pacific Rim. And so I was curious then, what are some of the other possible impacts of an El Nino besides some, even though, as some of your research has pointed out, complicated connections to tropical cyclone activity?
Yes, if you study tropical cyclones, then you are fully aware of how complicated things are, for sure. So, one of the most important and reliable El Nino impacts is that the Atlantic hurricane season is weaker than average. So, we tend to see fewer storms and they tend to be weaker. Certainly doesn't mean we're having no storms. In the past, we have had very significant hurricanes during El Nino years. So, I don't want your listeners to just completely check out when it comes to the hurricane season in the Atlantic.
As I like to say, it only takes one, right?
It only takes one, that's what we say too.
Yeah.
And conversely, we tend to see a stronger hurricane season in the eastern and central Pacific basin. So weaker in the Atlantic and stronger in the Pacific.
If you're just joining us, this is Weather Realness, the podcast about weather and climate from the Illinois Public Media and the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. I'm Deanna Hentz, Associate Professor in the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. We're talking with Emily Becker, Research Associate Professor in the Rosenstiel School of Marine, Atmospheric, and Earth Science at the University of Miami. So, Emily, let's transition to talking about this particular upcoming event. Why are forecasters calling this year's El Niño a super El Niño, and why are they paying so close attention to this phenomenon?
So this year, we have a very confident forecast that tropical Pacific sea surface temperature that is the first indicator of El Nino, that is going to be much warmer than average. And by much warmer, I only mean 3 or 4 or 5 degrees Fahrenheit. I'm not talking that it's going to boil away or anything. So we have a very confident forecast that will be much warmer than average. We also are seeing, as I mentioned earlier, some involvement of the global warming trend in that. So it looks like the surface of the tropical Pacific may be a record warm. However, it doesn't necessarily mean that El Nino is going to be record strong. When it comes to the re atmospheric response and how that changes global atmospheric circulation, we are still expecting a very strong event, but not necessarily the wildly extreme, never before seen in our 75-year record kind of event.
Well, yeah, and that gets us to, well, what are some of the main concerns about this super El Nino? I mean, you mentioned that the ocean may have this strong response, but the atmosphere may not. So how can this possibly translate into the atmospheric response?
We are still expecting El Nino itself to be very strong too. So we expect to see a strong atmospheric response. However, what that really means is There are certain impacts that we expect to see during El Nino. We expect more rain across the southern tier of the U.S., less rain in the Midwest, in fact, and less snow through the Midwest, and many global impacts. So when El Nino is stronger, we have a greater chance that those events will happen. It's weather. I suspect any of your regular listeners know that it is highly unpredictable, and things can always happen that we don't expect. But with that very strong El Nino, we have a much greater chance that we will see those impacts across the world.
That gets into thinking about one concern that has been getting passed around a lot is that climate scientists are saying that there may be a spike in global temperature and that could set some new heat records as one of the possible impacts. And so, especially with this relationship to temperature, what are some possible shifts that could happen with this event? But then also, how does this interact with the longer term warming trend that we're seeing?
Yeah, so out of the last 7 or so decades, the warmest year in terms of global mean temperature, the warmest year of each decade has been an El Nino year. And conversely, the coolest year of that decade has been a La Nina year. However, of course, the trend overall is positive. So the coolest year of the 90s was warmer than the warmest year of the 60s, and that has continued. So we have a very good chance, yes, of seeing a new record in 2027. It's usually the year that follows the peak of El Nino. So El Nino is developing and will peak late this year. So the global mean temperature records are often set the following year. So yes, it is pretty likely that we will see a new record for that, if not a record in the top one or two, or top two. 2016 was a new record for us. And before that, we had 1998 that was very, very clear following large El Nino events.
Well, and that brings us actually, as you mentioned, that, you know, El Nino typically peaks in the wintertime. And so, you know, as some of the strongest signal that we see in terms of response also tends to coincide with the winter. Scientists are predicting that we may have a wetter winter in certain parts of North America, like the South or possibly the West Coast. Especially with a lot of the water concerns that we're seeing in with respect to the snowpack in the western part of the United States and some of the other parts of the country facing drought. Why could we see some of the differences in precipitation and what kind of precipitation that we may see in these different parts of the country?
Yeah, El Nino is often, especially when we're looking at a very strong or super event as is developing this year, often held up as an object of fear, but it's really an opportunity to anticipate where we're going to see rain and where we're not over the course of the winter. And in the Southeast, in Miami, Florida, along with the rest of the Southeast, has been extremely dry this year. And so we are hoping that those rains will ameliorate some of that drought and help with the wildfire situation we have. Of course, Southern California and the Southwest can always use rain. Those impacts are important. And there are following impacts too. Whereas in the winter in Texas, we can see more rain. That tends to correlate with a less extreme, in Texas it's always warm in the summer, but a less extreme heat season in the summer. So El Nino is really a chance to get prepared for impact and to anticipate where they are going to hit.
If you're just joining us, this is Weather Realness, the podcast about weather and climate from Illinois Public Media and the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. I'm Deanna Hintz, Associate Professor in the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. We're talking with Emily Becker, Research Associate Professor in the Rosenstiel School of Marine, Atmospheric, and Earth Science at the University of Miami. So we've been talking a lot about the different impacts of an El Nino event and the anticipation of it. So this brings us to talking about this term super El Nino. It is considered an informal, non-scientific term. So I'm just curious, what are your thoughts on the use of this terminology? And is there a better term that we could be using instead?
NOAA and the World Meteorological Organization and other meteorological organizations don't have a super category. However, I've kind of come around to it. I think it is helpful in communicating to the public that this is a substantial event that we need to pay attention to. It provides our only real source of predictability on seasonal timescales. So it provides the only information we have, but it provides a lot of information and we need to understand this. So if super raises awareness, I'm all for it. 2015-16, I think somebody nicknamed it Godzilla.
Yes.
So honestly, I'll take super. Is at least a modifier.
Well, now that I'm actually hearing that there's some ideas to perhaps start naming heat domes, so we'll see what happens. Ooh. In terms of other new fun terms. I remember Superstorm Sandy getting the Frankenstorm moniker. Mm-hmm. So there's some really fun opportunities for people to be creative around this, for sure.
Tropical cyclones did it first, but we might as well pile on.
Why not? Yeah, well, and I also just wanted to ask you about your research around this topic, because, as I said, we're talking about this anticipation and the way that people talk about this leading up to this event. But your research is looking at how past El Niños can set up expectation for the impacts that we may see from it, both in terms of weather and climate. So how much can people really rely on those past events to know what to expect when an El Niño is predicted to happen?
Yeah, it's a terrific question, and it varies quite a lot regionally. But one example I would use is Southern California. There have been three very strong El Nino events in the past 50 years or so, 1982, 83, 1997, 98, and 2015, 16. And out of those three, two of them saw extreme and flooding rains in Southern California. So that's two out of three, two thirds of the time. And I think that's actually a pretty good example. So you would probably bet on more rain occurring, but you would also understand that there's a 33% chance that that rain isn't going to happen. The southeastern U.S., on the other hand, about 8 in 10 El Nino events have had more rain than average. So using those prior events gives us an idea of which way the odds are tilted. All of these forecasts have to be considered as probabilities. We're never, if anybody tells you, well, El Nino is coming, so you're going to get 20 inches of rain, then don't pay attention to that. But if somebody tells you, hey, you know, El Nino is coming and it's likely that your winter in Illinois will be less snowy than average, then we all inherently understand how to use that probability and looking forward into the winter.
And that's also that, you know, communicating of the uncertainty around mm-hmm. that as well. Absolutely. And I think one thing that's really interesting about your research is that, you know, people might find it intuitive to think that or expect that the stronger an El Nino is, the more chaotic or more unpredictable it might be, but you've actually found the opposite. So can you explain to us why that is and why a stronger event is actually more likely to align with our historical expectations?
Yeah, I really appreciate that question because it does look at things from a perspective that I hadn't really seen before. And the reason that El Nino, a stronger El Nino, has actually a less chaotic and more predictable outcome is that El Nino changes the global circulation in ways that we understand. So you get that increased rainfall clouds in a specific location in the tropical Pacific, and we understand the dynamics of how that changes the atmosphere. So it actually reduces some of the chaos in the atmosphere by forcing it to follow these paths, by really driving the atmospheric circulation from a specific location instead of wherever.
Yeah, and I basically understand from that where that if the El Nino event is on the weaker side, then the influence of other phenomena can maybe play more of a role in then what outcome that we have. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, very much so. Well, you know, we know that weather and storms are unpredictable, and the storm track, which is the path that storms tend to take from the Pacific into North America, to focus on North America for the moment, there are storm tracks around the world, but that storm track can sort of wobble around if there is no guide for it. And El Nino provides a guide. It tends to extend the jet stream farther and farther east across the Pacific and to push it farther south, which is why we get those increased rains across the southern U.S. Mm-hmm. and decreased rains across regions of the northern U.S. So it, essentially, El Nino provides that guide that isn't there otherwise, which allows random variability, storms, short-term impacts to really go nuts.
Yeah, well, Emily, thank you so much for breaking all of this down for us today. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity. It's a lot of fun.
We've been talking with Emily Becker, Research Associate Professor in the Rosenstiel School of Marine, Atmospheric, and Earth Science at the University of Miami. I'm Deanna Hintz, Associate Professor in the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Thank you for joining us on Weather Realness. Do you have a weather or climate question you want us to answer? Leave us a voicemail at 217-333-2141 or email weatherrealness@illinois.edu.